Now, all week long, we've been bringing you the student-produced radio series, Pieces from the Post-Industrialized Places Project at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Students have been working, interviewing, recording, and editing these pieces throughout the semester. So without further ado, here's the final installment of Stories of Deindustrialized Baltimore. This episode, Futures.
This week, we have been learning about the processes and impacts of industrialization and deindustrialization within the communities of Baybrook and Sparrows Point. Today, we will be talking about the futures of these communities. Local voices address deindustrialization of these communities and the residents' desire to bring new life into these areas in many different ways. Throughout today's mix, we will hear music from the Curtis Bay Seniors, sounds from the Free Your Voice protest against Energy Answers Incinerator that is planned for Baybrook, interviews from the Filbert Street Community Garden, and steelworkers' reflection on the closure of Sparrows Point Steel Mill. The theme of today's piece is that to envision the future of these industrial communities, we must understand the past and act in the present. Tempo.
There were always Arabs coming around Fairfield. But you mentioned the soil down there, most everybody had his own garden. My mother had a vegetable garden for a while, but she decided that she didn't. So she had my brother and my sister and some of the neighbors get together and dig the lawn up, grade the lawn, the garden rather, grade the garden, and make her a lawn. And one corner of that lawn, closest to the house, she had a beautiful flower garden. And if you want to get in trouble, you break some of her flowers.
And my mom was like that too.
If you want to get in trouble, you break some of mom's flowers. But she loved the flowers.
But there have been, for example, I'll give you a great example, Jason Reed, who runs the community garden. He's, you know, you could say that's a volunteer program. He came up with this idea. He was looking for a group to sponsor him. We signed on as his sponsor, and he got an open society fellowship. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that was really great that happened.
And if we don't, as Don said, start talking about American manufacturing and taking positive steps to reignite its rebirth, we're going to have a future where you're really going to have more so than you do today. The haves, that 1%, and the rest of us will be nothing more than peasants. You know, and it's happening right in front of our eyes. So I am a positive person, and I'm going to do what I can. And I know a lot of people in this room are going to do what they can to try to stem this free fall, because we have to. Our economic livelihoods depend on it.
No more trash! No more trash! No more trash!
I'm a steel worker. And you know what? There is nothing that's ever going to replace going. And there's actually probably like 15 or so steel workers in here. I don't think we're going to get a steel mill there again. But for God's sake, put an auto plant. Screw the Amazon work centers for $10 an hour. I don't. Warehouses suck. Build something. That would be ideal. I think nothing's going to go there. I think it's going to be a huge waste of 3,500 acres of great manufacturing land that thousands of Dundalk and Sparrows Point and Middle River kids could go work at. Dream World, yeah, they'd build a huge steel complex again. But just a wish list, right?
Look, The Filbert Street Garden, which started 4 years ago, I got involved with at its start when the community association called me and said that they wanted to reinvigorate their community garden and to start a garden education program and that they wanted me to lead it. The main goal of the garden is education. So the Filbert Street Garden is all about education. The goal or the vision for the garden as a place is to be a hub, a community-managed hub, where people can come and teach each other and share information in a safe place where making mistakes is not a problem.
Put your dirt trash right here.
JJ said put some butt into it.
Oh, okay. I'll turn. Get it straight up. There you go.
Jump on it.
And it's up to the people at your university and people at all of the universities around this country to be the difference makers. Because right now, I am not optimistic that if we continue shutting down factories and building fast food restaurants, that we can sustain ourselves.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the march. All right, so today we will be marching to the incinerator site. Thank you all for coming. Now, first I want to say thank you to a lot of amazing people in Greece that helped us get where we are today. And we are a group called Free Your Voice, and we're made up of a lot of students and United Workers.
Well, my name is Stephanie Garcia, and I literally just started as an AmeriCorps today. So I had gotten involved with a plot here at the garden, and once I've seen how, you know, the women are trying to get involved with the community, I want the women to get involved with the community. I want to be involved with the community because I do live here as well. So when I came, okay, so I came down here from New York, I should say that. And so yeah, that's pretty much how I got involved with it, and I saw that they needed some more extra help, and I really.
So when you're planting the trees, what you're going to do is dig a much larger hole than you think you need, about the size of a 5-gallon bucket.
Okay.
The dirt that you pull out of the hole, you're going to get a wheelbarrow full of that black compost. Mix that half and half with the dirt. So okay. Same amount dirt and compost. Throw enough dirt back in the hole to create like a pyramid, you know, the tree down, and let the roots splay out over the pyramid, and then fill the rest with it.
Shannon Delbuck, and I was born and raised here in Curtis Bay. I grew up on Olmsted Street, and when I was in elementary school right across the street, Curtis Bay Elementary, I had a plot here at the Filbert Street Garden. So I think that part of me coming back to Baltimore after having gone to grad school and gone to college and moving away and coming back and living in Baltimore City, one of the things that I was interested in was after learning that the garden had come back and was being like sort of reborn and there was like this new interest in it, was finding a way to become a part of it again.
It's incredibly important to me that the Filbert Street Garden continue to serve as a model for the rest of the city. In order for that to happen, we need to continue to sustain the programs that we have and build a stronger space for the community to enjoy. Since I began working with the community of Curtis Bay in the garden, this space has gone from an empty, vacant lot to a productive educational resource. Community members come out, they walk, they share the space, they enjoy the environment, and by the time they leave, they have a better understanding of how they can have a healthier life.
We hope you have enjoyed the final installment in this week's series on industrial boom and bust in the Baltimore region. Today you've heard the voices of John Jeffries, Ivan Lashinsky, Mike Lewis, Chris McLaren, Jason Reed, Stephanie Garcia, Shannon Novak, and the audio recordings from the protest march organized by the Free Your Voice student organization. The entire week-long series was produced by University of Maryland Baltimore County students, and today's piece was produced by Calvin Perry and Dustin Roddy. We would like to thank our UMBC professors, Stephen Bradley, Nicole King, Bill Shoebridge, and Michelle Stefano for their support and guidance on this project, as well as the Breaking Ground Civic Engagement Initiative at UMBC for providing funding for these courses. We also greatly appreciate Mark Steiner and the Center for Emerging Media for support, guidance, and opportunity to share these stories with you this week. For more information on this project, please visit the Mark Steiner Show website, as well as mappingbaybrook.org and millstories.org. And please consider joining us for an evening of food, music, silent auctions, raffles, and games to raise money for the Filbert Street Community Garden. The Filbert Street Community Garden is a conservation project, educational space, and food farm located in the Curtis Bay neighborhood of Baltimore. The gala will be held this Sunday, May 18th, from 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. at 2640 Space, which is located at 2640 St. Paul Street in Charles Village. Tickets can be purchased at the event or on missiontix.com.
All right, welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner. Of course, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word. That's MarylandEducators.org. We're joined here in studio now by some of the students who produced this series. They worked really hard, and this is an incredible piece, as you've just heard. We're here with Naila Henry, who is Media and Communication Studies and Social Work double major at UMBC. Darcy Placilla, who is American Studies major at UMBC. Zoe Gensheimer, Visual Arts major at UMBC. Calvin Perry, Maryland American Studies major at UMBC. And Bonnie Bowen, graduating American Studies major with focus in education. Her husband worked at Sparrows Point until it closed. Good to have you over with us in the studio.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And you all can join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages, or you can tweet me at Mark Steiner during the course of the conversation, 410-319-8888. So I'm just curious, what do you all glean from this? This has been a long project, four different classes.
Yes.
A lot of work. So, I mean, I'm really curious what comes to you at the end of this that says something that you really didn't think about, expect, and kind of looking at the places you visited. Darcy?
Oh, gosh. I didn't expect the sense of accomplishment that I feel. We've put in a lot of work, like you said, and I think, I feel like so relieved. So relieved that
it's finally done,
and I feel so thankful that I got to talk with all these people and go to the community garden and learn a little bit about how radio is produced. And I feel like not only a sense of accomplishment, but I feel like I've learned so much.
And Bonnie, this is a walk back home in some ways for you because of your family.
Yeah,
the connections to this place, right?
At Sparrows Point, I had my husband work there and my stepson work there. So when I got into this class with the Sparrows Point side, I was like, it kind of allowed me to know the community that was involved in it. I never kind of understood my husband and some of the things that he maybe talked about or the way he was until I started hearing interviews and interviewing other steelworkers and realized this huge connection in this community that was inside of Sparrows Point that I can learn about, but I can't really truly understand because I didn't work there.
Which is what you all were trying to do in creating the pieces you did.
Absolutely.
It's kind of for people to feel what was going on. Go ahead, Calvin.
Definitely. I didn't really realize how big and real this project was till basically right now when we walked into the studio. It didn't really hit me that it was so real. It wasn't like a typical school project where it didn't really impact anything. We're really working with a community. It's really impacting people's lives.
That is, I think, the real difference here in this project and other things that might happen in academia is that you were in the community gleaning stories, meeting people you'd never met before, and it has to be, in some senses, for you and everybody else, Naila, kind of, I mean, transformative.
Yeah, I really appreciate the experience to get out into the community because when you're in school and you're doing these projects and you're studying, it's at the end of the semester you get a grade. You get a grade and maybe some papers back and some feedback, whereas when you're out in the community working with these people, you get to, here's this project that you worked on with your classmates, and you were able to give something back to the community that, you know, ultimately our university is a part of that community. So it's a really nice experience.
And I was thinking about how Zoe, given the work you were doing with this as well, that this is a world where kind of analyzing community but getting to hear people's voices marries the creative, coming out with something more than just, as Nellie was saying, a paper.
Yeah, definitely. And just getting the chance to listen to the stories and like editing them over and over again, hearing these voices, they sort of just come into my head all the time, and I'm remembering when I'm doing it other things, I'm remembering their voices. And like, for example, Stanley Stupai talking about getting on the trolley car with his ladder and paint bucket and brushes and just going to do side jobs, or like, you know, some of the more industrial stories of someone falling in an acid pit or scraping the windows.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So those connect us to the larger history of Baltimore, and that's the really interesting part of the story.
So, because this is the world really separate from most people in the world now. I mean, this is a world that defined this city, defined this state, defined worlds that were black and white and Eastern European and from all over the world together in Appalachia in this one parts of our community. So I'm curious what that says to you, because this is generations that came before you. You know, these were very separate from the worlds you lived in. So how do you relate to that? What did it say to you? What do you think it was? What did we lose here, do you think?
You mean in the connection from the past to the present right now?
Yeah, for hearing these voices, producing these pieces, talking to these people, what is it you kind of really feel like you have gleaned from this about what connection we have to all this?
I think the connection is with this radio program, it really allowed me to look at the different stories through the communities and allowing the community members to have a voice. And I think that's why this was so powerful, because it was them telling their stories. We were just merely editing and, you know, putting them together, but it really allowed us to dig deeper as a class into these stories and to really connect with some. Maybe you can connect with the struggle of, you know, Loretta happened to take her child up there as a mom. I can connect with that. It might not have happened to me, but I can connect with that struggle as a mother. So you can find pieces of the struggle that you can connect to and bring it into to today's time.
You know, that Loretta piece would have to take her baby up into the crane to work because you had no one to take care of your child and had to do that. That's just... Zoe, you look like you're about to say something. Go ahead.
Also, just connecting to thinking about Baltimore as being like a really industrial area and having people come from all over the country to work there versus, you know, when a lot of people left during like white flight, and sort of thinking about where Baltimore is now. You know, it seems like a lot of people are coming back into the area for the arts, at least, and just tying into that.
But could you feel a connection to these people at all?
Yeah. Yes. Definitely. Yeah. I was just going to say, like, when you hear the voices pop up, or even when we just saw Mike Lewis walk in, and we're like, oh my gosh, it's Mike Lewis. Like, we just get so excited because you're listening to these voices over and over again, and you start to feel some kind of connection with them from editing their voices over and over again. It's just really, it's really interesting.
Darcy, go ahead, and then we'll close out over here.
I feel like they're almost, in a way, like my family.
Yeah.
I agree. Listening to these voices over and over again, hearing the nuances in their voices, and some of it we've seen through video recordings. So you get to see the facial expressions. I remember a man nicknamed Hambone, and his stories, he's a really interesting character. He's the one that sticks out to me, Hambone, and he's the one that hits on me.
Final thought.
Yeah, like Darcy was saying, I feel like we're listening to these people's life's histories and oral recordings and stuff, and I feel like we know them and they're friends and family, and it just, you really connect with them somehow. Even though you've never met them before, so maybe they feel like family.
Well, I'm going to say that you did incredible work. It was a joy and a pleasure working with you all this last semester, and I think what you've created is very important. It'll live on the Steiner Show website, and we really want people to check that out and connect to all the other parts of the project, the mapping projects and the other parts of this project that were connected to this project. That with some great depth will all be there for you to connect with at steinershow.org. And I want to thank all of you being in the studio, Nayila Harry, Darcy Placilla, Zoe Gensheimer, Calvin Perry, and Bonnie Bowen. Good luck, and this has been great. You've done incredible work.
Thank you very much.
This has been good. We're going to take a very brief break and come back and meet some of the folks that were in these pieces from the communities, and we are going out with the Chiffons. Those of a certain age, One Fine Day. Good song. So dance on away. We're doing that because on this day, Barbara Lee Alicia Farms was born in 1947. We'll be right back with the voices you heard. Stay with us. All right, welcome back. Janis Jackson was born on this day. Janet Jackson. I say Janis? Janet Jackson was born on this day in 1966. Of course, that's why we're playing her piece. That's the way love goes. And I did what we sometimes joke about as a Steiner here when I don't follow my script as closely as I should. These guys are staying in the studio for a few more minutes, so they're still with us before we meet with the folks in the clips themselves. So good to have you staying. Glad you're staying. So, well, let's just pick up where we left off, because I'm really curious about this in terms of it being beyond an academic exercise, an academic piece of work in the usual way. As you were talking about earlier, Naila, you said, you know, you should do a course and you write a paper and then you're done, you walk away. But in this sense, A, you're doing an analysis of culture that in our own communities and doing a deep analysis of that culture, following that up with working with interviewing people in those communities. But when you do that, you become embedded in it in some ways. As you were saying, Zoe, you hear the voices, right? You can't separate yourself. So how does this change your perspective on society? How did this change how you look at who we are and where we're going, what we've become?
I wouldn't say that it so much changed my perspective on society, but it did change my perspective on what needs to be done in order to get to a place where we want to be. So how Darcy said that, you know, the voices you hear start to feel like family. It's not a project you can easily walk away from. It stays on your heart and your mind. And when you're out in the city, you want to do things that kind of contribute to that. So when you think about the garden and the garden gala that's going on, you want to contribute to what's going on in the city. You don't just want to pick up and leave. You want to make sure that you're leaving it better than how you came to, how you started off.
Anybody else to jump in?
I mean, for me, just like Naila was saying, it really, you can't walk away from it. I mean, my major was changed by this course.
What do you mean? What happened?
I came into this course being an emergency health services major, and I just, the way this course impacted me, I just can't really imagine myself doing anything else, really. Like, just doing this sort of social work and helping the community, like giving back to the community. Like, I want to keep doing that from this.
So this is a profound course.
It was. It really was for me.
That's very interesting.
I think for me, the biggest thing that I've realized is that I've become a better listener. I've become a better, almost a better person for doing this project, because I can listen to people better. I can relate to people better. And this has just moved me and made me want to do something, made me want to change and maybe address the problems that are going on within the communities and see what I can do to help rather than just walking away and moving someplace else maybe.
Go ahead, Zoe.
Also, just thinking about how the community members, when they're talking about these industries that they've worked for over the years, they talk about the struggles and like the environmental degradation and like the health risks that they face, but they also talk about the community that was built there. So I think that it's interesting, you know, the power of the industry, what they did, and then how they sort of moved out and left the communities, and how they have fallen apart in a lot of ways. So I think it's a good way to look at how we could work together as a people, as the city, to create change, and how much power we have together.
When you said how much power we have together, I mean, let's take off on that for a moment. I mean, I think that, I mean, I'm curious whether doing this kind of research and talking to people in communities that we call the deindustrialized communities of Baltimore, does that make you more jaundiced, pessimistic about where we're going? What does it say to you about what could have happened and didn't have to happen?
I just think that what happens happened, so we can't fix that. But what I do think is our future, we have to listen to both sides. We need industry, and we also need environment. And I think that with working with these two classes, it really provides an eye-opening. We really need to work together, both sides. We need jobs. These people in these communities need jobs, but also we need our health too. There has to be, and I don't have an answer for it, but there has to be a way that we are smart Americans. We have to be able to figure out a way to have both and coincide together, because without jobs, people have no money to live. And without that, does her health matter? So it just really, to me, has almost put a fight in my head. Like, I always was like, oh, environment. And then I got a husband who's a steel worker, you know, worked at the steel mill. Well, we need jobs. So it's almost made this like mixing in my head. Like, what do we do? But I know that I now want to have a voice in it. And I now want to help. And you can help like through the gardens. You can help through demonstrations. You can go to some of these rallies and you can help. And you can say, hey, we're here. You can be a part of that community and you can have a voice.
Anybody else want to leap in on top of that?
Well, yeah, I think it speaks to...
Ayla.
Thank you. I think it speaks to we need to work together, how Bonnie was saying, and we need to take multidisciplinary approaches to it because not one side has the answer, and it's going to take more than one person working together in order to get these things done and not just, you know, having conversations. While it is, you know, important to discuss things, it's also moving the conversation from discussion to action and making sure that we are getting out there and, you know, doing things in a hands-on way to make sure that things are getting done.
And I think with action, there's a lot of mistakes that happen. You have to learn how to bounce back. You have to learn how to figure out what went wrong and kind of change your path and change your direction in order to bridge these two industry and the environment and make it work. So sometimes it doesn't always work. Sometimes you have to reanalyze yourself.
No, this raises a lot of issues about, I mean, because you're talking about communities that have been contaminated in terms of the environment, chemically contaminated, people's lives affected by that, health affected by that. But trying to struggle with how you can rebuild, what comes next. I love the steel worker in one of the last segments we did here talking about, you know, we don't need the $10 an hour Amazon jobs. We need serious work and serious jobs, and let's put something there that works, and not just condominiums for folks with lots of money. But now, how does this garden that you all are pushing at the end of each program fit into all this? What are you pushing here?
A grassroots, it's pretty much like a grassroots type of an organization. People in Baltimore or in surrounding areas can change their communities, and they can do it by taking small steps like these gardens. They can bring this green back to their garden. They can have a say if they have fresh produce. I mean, it's a way you can empower yourself from like a grassroots. You don't have to wait for the government to help you. You don't have to. I mean, this is people working together for a community of something that they want. They want fresh produce. They want the space to learn and have a garden together and have a place to be a community.
Yeah. Well, and I think it speaks to when you talk about the citizens pulling together for themselves and, you know, kind of answering, finding solutions for their own problems, because health is an issue within the city, and, you know, you don't have access, some communities don't have access to the fresh, healthy food that you need, and if you want to go out and get jobs and make sure your body is functioning the way that it should, but you can't get to the grocery store or you can't get, you know, the fresh food that you need. And so things like the garden and people who do have their own way to do that kind of moves the process along.
Zoe, we're about to say, well, I saw you're about to say something.
I was basically the same as Naila. Just with, you know, when the deindustrialization happened, a lot of the businesses left. And so there's food deserts in these areas. And it is an empowering thing to be able to, you know, plant things in the ground and have something that you can eat. So just putting that, the communities taking that power for themselves and really, you know, having that to show for themselves.
I think it does raise the questions you all are talking about where the future is going to go. And, you know, we are not today, but when we talk to everybody about the future, but sometime soon we're going to have this discussion debate about what should be built in this place, the thing that people call incinerator, some people don't want to call an incinerator, versus some other kind of way of building jobs. And I think that's what people are struggling around, what should come next. you know, what goes out there for people to be able to walk in and work. And I think that's a big piece of what is left here, this hole that's left.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, and I think that's a question that you all, I mean, left there for people to wrestle with, which I think is important. I think one of the things you did really well with this is you didn't come to conclusions. You offered a story for people to wrestle with. You know, which is, I think, good. I mean, it's a good way to do it, because otherwise it could have been very kind of, pedantic, you know, mm-hmm. And you didn't let that happen. So so you walk into these places. Any relationships you think are going to last?
I hope so, because I live within a mile of the community garden, and I really see myself down there. And I'm going to be a teacher after graduation, and I hope
like a public school teacher?
Yes. Uh-huh. So I'm hoping to, I'm not saying that school, but I'm hoping to find a school that I can work in a garden and maybe call Jason Reed up and say, hey, can you give me some pointers on how to start a community garden or have a school involved in a green type of a thing. So I hope that I do. I hope that I stick to what I want and that I go and I'm down there on community work days. I really enjoyed going down there and just digging and helping and bringing my kids down there to help. It became like a part of me and I wanted to continue.
Yeah, Zoe.
Yeah, and I don't know if I'll, you know a lot of the people that I've met, but just being aware of Brooklyn and Curtis Bay. I mean, I grew up in Baltimore City, but it is across the water. It is a separate area, and it was
right.
Very isolated for a long time before the bridges were built. So just sort of having this sudden awareness of, you know, Sparrows Point existing and really getting a sense of what went on there is definitely going to open a lot of experiences in the future for me.
That I think, I guess, is another important part of this series, and also for you all as well. I mean, that because it even says in the series, I mean, that these neighborhoods were separate, as you just said, from the rest of the city, isolated from the city. Baltimore's like that. I mean, you can be from the west side of Baltimore and never even see Dundalk, even though it's there, right? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of this world that was opened up. go ahead, Neil. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, being in this class really does push you to, you know, cross those boundaries and to get out into the community and kind of explore and experience what's out there. And so I think that just by example, you know, you can push people to get out there and to do more. And to, if you've been in the city and you don't even know anything about that area, then why not take a trip out there? It's a pretty nice area. They have parks, the garden is beautiful, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it's a great opportunity, and like hearing these stories might make someone want to check out what's going on.
Speaking of that, someone's got to tell us what's happening Sunday night. You promote this thing every at the end of each piece. So what exactly is happening Sunday night?
We're having an event at 2640 Space to hopefully raise funds for the community garden director position.
Yes.
Yeah. We're going to raise funds for it. There will be live local bands playing. There will be auctions and food, and it'll just be a really nice time, and the history of the communities will be presented, and it'll just be a really enlightening
2640 St. Paul, the old church there.
The old church, yeah.
I'm really excited that we got at least two acts from Curtis Bay to come down and do it. Baby Boy's going to be there, and it's somebody help me.
Oh.
Double Impact?
No. Double Impact?
Double impact.
That's the one.
but they're really good, and I just think it's great that we're involving the community even more in the celebration of their garden and helping us raise funds for their garden. I just think that part is just, I'm just so excited about having them there.
It's be great. Well, we'll all be there Sunday. And now we can say thank you. I'm glad you all were in the studio. I got my timing right this time. These incredible students who came from UMBC in this deindustrialization project that I was really honored to work with over the last bunch of months and working on this stuff. And it's been great. Nayela Henry, Darcy Placilla, Zoe Gensheimer, Calvin Perry, Bonnie Brown, Bowen, excuse me. Good to have you all here.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for this work. And now we are going to meet some of the people that were in this series. We're going out here with Chuck Brown's Go-Go Swing. He died on this day in 2012 and was a guest in the show not long before he passed away. So the great Chuck Brown. All right, welcome back, folks. Now we are going to meet some of the folks who are in this series, and we're talking about what the future might bring in the communities that we have been talking about. We are joined in studio here by Shannon Delavook. I have that right?
Yes.
Good. She was a Baltimore artist graduate student at UMBC in the Master of Fine Arts program in Imaging and Digital Arts, and she grew up in Curtis Bay and it currently has a plot in the community garden. Good to meet you. Good. Welcome to the studio. Gary Brown is with us.
Yeah.
Gary Brown is a Benjamin Franklin High School junior who's manager of the Tri-Veggie Mobile Food Market program at the Filbert Street Community Garden that the students use to sell produce in the community. Good to meet you. Welcome to the studio.
Yeah, I'm actually there. So.
Good to have you here. Stephanie Garcia is with us. Stephanie Garcia is an AmeriCorps intern with the Filbert Street Community Garden. Good to have you as well. Mm-hmm. And Mike Lewis is back in the house. Mike Lewis, of course, financial officer of the United Steelworkers Local 9477, who worked at Sparrows Point for 34 years. Good to see you, ma'am. And we may be being joined as well by Loretta Smith, who was in that piece. She has a lot of, she's taking care of some family stuff this morning, but if she can, she'll be joining us here. She worked at Sparrows Point since the early 70s and ran the Women of Steel Committee at the United Steelworkers Local Union 9477. Let me begin this way. This is somebody who was at the event that took place at the Creative Alliance, who is a steelworker, who edited the Steelworker newspaper for a long time, who I've known forever since we were young organizers together back in the day, way back in the day. His name is Lenny Schindel. And Len Schindel wrote this poem about the mill and sent it to me the other night on Facebook. And I decided, I think, to start the conversation off is to read what Len wrote about the steel mill. And he's a great writer. He's a good friend, and it was great to see him. He's in pretty good shape for an old man. So here we go. In the distance, behind a sign advertising 3,300 acres for lease, a steel mill is meeting what free market economists call creative destruction. 2 years after the shutdown, the searing pain of those who tended the fiery furnaces and raging machines is still raw. Some have comforted themselves with cliched memes about new doors opening when other doors close. But everyone knows even they would go back in a heartbeat. Back to the co-workers who had their backs, shared the pride as the hardened industrial soldiers of Sparrows Point, encircled by the soft and the unappreciative. Now the impotence is theirs. Facebook posts chronicle each implosion as the salvage firm clears the island of its rust, finally uprooting storied buildings where so many thrived and others died. The coup de grace will be delivered by dynamite to the Big L, one of the largest blast furnace in the Western Hemisphere. Once the largest blast furnace in the Western Hemisphere. Everyone asks, when? The Brinks truck has already come to pick up the precious metals that are collected on the floor of the furnace, bubbling out of ore that was once mounded in dark pyramids on adjacent ships and shore. After the charges are set and the massive structure lies in wretched defeat, the salvage firm will tally up the price of its remains on the spot market for scrap. And in an insult as vicious as the implosion itself, some say the hulking and gnarled payload could be sold to fire the electric furnaces of competitors who haughtily spat at Sparrows Point and its union. But what about the star, asked the workers. The star, proudly erected by the plant's iron workers, topping the furnace each Christmas. The star, towering, powerful, proclaiming. To gritty neighbors and passing strangers in their BMWs and Porsches, Sparrows Point is alive, open for business, undefeated. Stay strong. What will happen to the star, they ask. The star that hallowed the special place. Before the salvage firm came. That was former steelworker Len Schindel's poem honoring the star and Sparrows Point. Thank you, Len, for that.
Yes. Powerful.
And so, Mike, let me start with you, my friend. Good to see you, man.
Good to see you, as always.
Always Mark. Good to see you. So, what do you think about Len's piece?
It's awesome.
Let me get too close to that mic, but
It's an awesome piece, and it's something written from a man's heart. Who's speaking on behalf of the final 2,000 souls that worked there until the plant closed. He's speaking also for the community that was enriched by the plant's presence. And it's almost like a eulogy in a way. It's a poetic eulogy to a way of life that many of us feel was taken away.
I mean, one of the things that was said in that by one of the workers in there, reflecting back, and I know this is true to extent, was not completely true given the testimony of all the people who were there. He said it wasn't always black and white. Our culture was steel. There's a steelworkers' culture. What did you think about that?
I think it's very well put because it's something that you almost had to be a part of. You know, you hear people say you don't understand what it was like to be a part of a fraternity, or some ladies might talk about their sorority unless you were a part of it. Well, we had a fraternity of brothers and sisters, union brothers and sisters, even some of the salary folks. It was a way of life. It was passed on. My grandfather came to the plant when he made the migration northward in 1927, him and my great uncle. And there's a lot of stories like that, that this was a generational thing. We took pride in what we did. We serviced the community. And I think a lot of people took it for granted. A lot of people took the economic impact that it had for granted. And when something like that is taken away, I think all of the stories over all of the years kind of roll together, and you see that the landscape is going to be forever changed. As that plant is torn down, even now right down there, you see a hole in the middle where something once stood that right. produced a valuable product.
I mean, I think what you also just said here is important, and I'm thinking about who's sitting in the room here, that plant and many of those plants around there, generations worked in them.
Right.
Father's son, grandson, great-grandson even, granddaughters worked in those plants, and that you knew that you could walk out of high school if you wanted to and get a job, decent wage, work hard, get a serious skill, do all the things you love on the side from boating to writing poetry to whatever that is you like to do and make a living and take care of your family.
Absolutely.
And that's gone. For your generation, that's not there.
My uncle worked there.
Your uncle worked there.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious how you think that what you all think that means for your generations. I mean, so you don't have that. Not saying either one of you or any of you wanted to be a steelworker. Maybe you did, maybe you didn't. I don't know. But other friends might have and can't. So what does that say to you?
I mean, I think that for me personally, a lot of my family, I have like four aunts and uncles, and my grandmother, she raised all five of her kids with the intention of them like staying close by. And one of my uncles was a Baltimore City fireman. My one uncle Dave, who worked for the steel mill. And so everybody sort of stayed close. My other uncle worked for the city, the Department of Transportation, as did my grandfather. So a lot of the family actually worked for the city. That was like what they did, and they stayed local. And when that plant shut down, it took away from my family. It was hard because that was all my uncle knew. And, you know, starting out in your mid-40s and trying to start over as a career, you know, that's difficult.
It's very hard.
Mm-hmm.
And what you just said, I think, is part of the power of the stories that we just heard over the last week that the students produced is about the community and what was lost. It's the community that was torn apart. Because you're right, people had jobs. They stayed. They could stay because there was a financial basis for which people could continue living in their homes and keeping family strong. Mm-hmm. And that's what kind of was lost. That got torn asunder.
And not only that, Mark, it was people that weren't working in the steel industry, but their business depended on the steel industry. Some of the smaller businesses that
right.
we always rave about in the North Point Road, Dundalk, Sparrows Point, Edgemere area, those businesses are suffering due to the ripple effect of the loss of that plant.
Yeah, we don't understand that the middle class was actually built. I mean, you're not just talking about Dundalk and the east side's middle class, but so many, like especially in the black community who live in the west side of town, who were steel workers, who made that journey every day to Sparrows Point and come back to the west side to live, all that helped build community in this whole city. It wasn't just that. What are your reflections on that, Gary?
I think that being though that I'm not really, I haven't lived here as long as most people, and I understand that like people feel deeply about the loss, like it's kind of crippling. Like you live here, and so that was like, it was like a cycle. Like you lived here, you worked here, and like you made a living from it. And for that to be taken away, it's like, where do you move to now? Like, you built a skill in that, and if that's gone, like, where do you move to? You have the skill set that doesn't really fit where you live.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about folks in your generation who just don't want to go to college. Now there's a world they have to figure out what to do with their lives, because everybody thinks everything's in college. But college isn't everything for everybody. It's not everybody's bath, right? Stephanie, you came in. Let me get that mic a little closer to you there. So just pull it down. Thank you so much. Good. Now we got your voice. So you came in from, where'd you come from?
New York.
New York. So so what are your senses of all this? Listen to this series, working in the community now as an AmeriCorps volunteer.
Okay. Well, I don't think, you know, I can say there are a lot of similarities from New York and in Baltimore. You know, it's really hard finding a job in New York as well as here. And, you know, I don't know much about, you know, what had happened, but it is hard, like, having something so stable taken away. It makes it difficult for people to want to try and want to make their community better when it's just falling apart and they can't do anything about it, or they feel like they can't do anything about it. So how I view it is that there's still hope, like, especially in my position, is, like, since I am, you know, full-time, I can reach out to, to the kids and get them more involved.
So we're going to talk more about the future here with our guests, the young and the old here. I realize we're going over our break time. We can take a very quick break. We're going to come back. We're going out with All Apologies by Nirvana, because this is the birthday of Nirvana bassist Chris Novoselic. Novoselic. I'm sorry. We're on this day in 1965. We'll be right back.
And you know,
all apologies. What else should I say? Everyone is gay. What else should I write?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Roadrunner by the Modern Lovers. Lead singer Jonathan Richman was born on this day in 1951. It's not my old Roadrunner song, but it'll do. So it's good. We continue our conversation here today about the post-industrialization project at UMBC that we've been hearing all week, produced by the students. People who are in that piece are joining us here on the air now. We are joined here in studio by Shannon Delavuk, who is a Baltimore artist, graduate student at UMBC in the Master of Fine Arts program in Imaging and Digital Arts, and grew up in Curtis Bay and currently has a plot in that community garden. Gary Brown is a Benjamin Franklin Jr., who's manager of the Tri-Veggie, is that right?
Yes.
Tri-Veggie? God, I'm going to hear more about that. Tri-Veggie Mobile Food Market Program at the Filbert Street Community Garden the students use to sell produce in the community. Stephanie Garcia is an AmeriCorps volunteer, and Mike Lewis is a financial officer for Steelworkers Local 9477, worked at Sparrows Point for 34 years, and has been a guest in the show numerous times now. He's becoming a regular. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Maybe you are from those communities themselves, Dundalk, Sparrows Point, Curtis Bay, Turner Station, Fairfield. Your thoughts about your family in those communities, and also just what happened and where we are going. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. Log on to our Facebook pages. 410-319-8888 is the number. I'll check those Facebook pages in just a moment. Well, tell us real fast, what is that?
Tri-Veggie is a student-run food market for our community, from our community. So we use produce that we grow in the local garden.
This is in Curtis Bay.
Yeah, it's on the Filbert Street Garden. Is like right near everything. It's like almost in the center of like everything in the Curtis Bay. It's not that big. Curtis Bay is not that big, but we use what we grow to try to bring healthy food to the community, because like the closest supermarket is like a mile off, and that's in Anne Arundel County, right over the line.
Hmm.
So We like sell salads. Everything in the salads are like homegrown right in the Filbert Street Garden. All the lettuce and the tomatoes and the carrots, and we sell that for like $2. And we sell homegrown tea. We have like our own tea plots, with
tea.
Yeah, tea.
And some drinking tea.
Yeah.
Huh.
All that for like $1, and we sell that. We go we started by going to the school, to the elementary school up the street, and when they let out, we'd sell tea. And we'd do that, like, every couple of days. And then we moved up to working events, and we'd sell, like, all the homegrown stuff that we make, and we'd tell people how to, like, raise their own plants at home.
And so you're involved in this garden as well?
Yeah, I have a plot there.
A plot?
Uh-huh.
Because you grew up there.
I did, and I had a plot there actually when I was a kid, when I was in elementary school. So it's interesting to come back as an adult and to be part of the same exact place that I was.
You don't live in Curtis Bay anymore.
I do not live in Curtis Bay. We actually just sold my grandmother's home last summer.
How'd that feel?
It was very emotional for me. I actually took a photograph of the bedroom, which was my bedroom, her bedroom, in the later part of the years of the house. And it was like the day before it sold. And it was just like kind of this nostalgic feeling. And so when I go back to the garden and I have to drive past the street that I grew up on and see the porch colored blue, you know, you just get like these feelings. And I went to the school that was right across the street. So it's really important for me to give back and to be part of the community still.
Before I ask you all about what you think the future could be for the communities that you grew up in and where they might go, and I was just hearing what you were saying. I mean, because this. Do you ever think that something will be created in your life that will have that sense of community that people had in Curtis Bay, in Sparrows Point, those places when you were growing up?
Would I have thought that?
Yeah, I mean, what do you think? Do you think it's possible to have that again, at some level?
Yeah, I am having that. I'm having that exact feeling right now and in my adulthood. You know, over 20 years later, I'm coming back to the same spot where, as a child, because I lived in a food desert, which at the time I didn't know that that's what it was. I didn't know that.
You grew up in that food desert.
I grew up in that food desert, because and it's still there.
Right.
and so I didn't know that, you know, 20 years later that I would be able to come back and to have an involvement and to work with the kids and to work with the high school students and work with elementary school students and work with the community members and to tell them about my story and my relationship to this same exact place and to hear their stories and for us to have a dialogue that I can like not just like come to as you know someone who's like also associated with the school as the students mm-hmm, who were just mm-hmm. talking but can come and actually like know exactly what they're talking about and feel that so yeah.
So what do you think, when you look at this place, I mean, what do you think about what the future might hold?
Well,
you know,
I'm really hopeful, somewhat optimistic about a trend of what they call insourcing. It may be in its infancy. We've outsourced so much that light's going off around this country that, you know, we've lost too much of our manufacturing base. And that is what was the engine that built this 20th century America, that built our middle class. We created things, and the creativeness of the American people is still there. We're innovative and we're creators. The thing is, we don't make our creations anymore. I read somewhere that not a single cell phone is manufactured in the United States.
Right.
And it's one of the biggest innovations of the 20th century. And that's the disconnect from where we were to where we evolved.
Solar was built and was created in this country, and most of it is not made in America anymore.
Right.
Even though it started here, we're pushing it out. I mean, that was made here,
and that
invented
has to,
here.
That has to change, Mark. We have to start taking care of home. We have to start seeing the connection between the loss of that segment of our economy and some of the social ills that are impacting our economy. Because we can't create a country where we only have minimum wage jobs. I mean, even $10.10 an hour is not a livable wage. That's just addressing a problem that's past due.
One of the questions I always ask politicians when they argue about minimum wage is I show them how much it is, and I said, why don't you take the minimum wage test and see if you can live for a week on $10.10 an hour. Go pay your rent and your mortgage and buy your groceries and fill up your car. See if that works.
Without touching the stash you have put up.
Don't touch. You can't touch a thing.
Just live off of that.
So right. What do you think about the future? This is your neighborhood. This is where you go to school.
I think that for like for generations future to be successful, like, you have to go to college. I think you need a plan. Like, you can't wing it, because, like, everything, it's like with the steel mill thing that collapsed, and with, like, people have things that they had, like, skill sets and stuff like that, where they are dedicated to this, and if that fails, you have nothing to fall back on. Like, there are people who have, like, aspire to be famous, but suppose you want to be famous and, like, play basketball, but you get an injury.
Everybody's mythological dream anyway, right?
Yeah,
right.
So after that, what are you going to do? Like, if you're injured and you're out, what's going to happen next? College is a ticket to, like, it's a door in a house filled with opportunity.
You see that as your ticket.
Yeah.
It's good that Gary sees that as his ticket, but we had college graduates lose their jobs at the point. You have college graduates with engineering degrees lose their jobs in the auto industry. It's not just the guy with the torch in his hand or the guy cutting that piece of scrap down at the steel plant. That plant and the residual jobs by it being there provided white-collar jobs as well. The steel plants, the auto industries, our manufacturing sectors. And what we're finding is that even people with college degrees are struggling in today's job market because they all benefited from that sector of the economy that is no longer there. So it drives up opportunity for people, even who have gone through and racked up student loan debt, you know.
So and so again, I'm coming back to this because, you know, I mean, to be an AmeriCorps volunteer means you decided to volunteer some of your life to kind of learn something new about this world and give back, right?
Yeah, and it is an experience. I'll say that, but it is an experience. But I really do have hope for Curtis Bay. It's like you can't want to change or fix a community if the community does not want to help. So raising awareness is very important, getting the word out there, you know, involving the kids, involving the parents, you know, the grandparents, whoever's willing to come and help out, you know, is like, it's good. So,
folks, you can join us here, 410-319-8888, and write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Or log on to our Facebook pages, tweet us at Mark Steiner. Your thoughts on where Baltimore's gone. The plants have all left. Auto workers are gone. Steel workers are gone. Curtis Bay had tons of different places for people to work that were related to the steel industry and not related to the steel industry, and all that has kind of evaporated and been destroyed. We've been searching what the deindustrialized communities mean. I'm curious. I mean, I know we won't get into it today too deeply, but I know there's a big battle over incinerator, no incinerator in Curtis Bay, and we'll have that debate coming up here soon on the show. I know that you would want to say about that, Shannon. I saw that look on your face. What were you going to say?
I don't think we have enough time. I have, like, pretty strong opinions about it, but but I think more so it's just that this is a community, and I and it's something that the community needs to be strongly involved in. And I think that's the only thing that I'll say, that this isn't just an issue that you can just push the people who are going to be affected by it and not listen to their voices and actually take them seriously.
And I think that that's part of all of this. I mean, when you look at this community or you look what happened with CSX and the battle over building the expanding CSX, and not taking into account what the neighbors are saying. People are saying, of course we need those jobs, we need to do something, but not taking into account what the neighbors' needs are and the community's needs are in the process of doing that, mm-hmm. not just kind of roughshod go in. We're doing this, we don't care what you say.
Right.
Right, that's a big piece of it. So how do you envision that change happening? Now, how do you envision, what would you envision for people who wanted to stay in the communities you live in and build a life? What would that life be now? I mean, creatively and otherwise, how would you see that life?
Without CSX?
No. I'm talking about, like, where you, in other words, right in Curtis Bay, where you all live, where you come from and where you live, right?
I live.
And where you're working. You live there now too, right? Mm-hmm. So what would, this is a place that once was full of both businesses and factories, places people made a living. And that's gone. What do you see replacing it? What keeps the community alive I mean, I know the garden's happening, which we'll talk about at the end again, but what keeps this community going in a large sense? Because people are not going to make $35,000-$40,000 working in the garden, right? I want that garden to be, because gardens are important. I'm a big believer in all that stuff. But I'm saying, so what do you see as the future?
I'm waiting for someone to tell me, some political leader or some business leader to tell me. They always say that this new economy will evolve and jobs will come back. And what we've seen in Baltimore City and what we've seen in other cities around the country is that when we lose our industrial base, nothing comes back to replace it that brought what that had. You know, the tax base, a lot of municipalities are suffering with tax revenue because the taxpayers aren't there anymore. People become productive working people now become needy of social programs because there's nothing there to replace it. I got a good friend of mine who worked at the Point for 34 years. She bought a home in Western Baltimore County, and she recently just got another job after being the same age as me, 53, and her job pays her $12.90 an hour. This is a person that was making $24 an hour. This is the person with a Western Baltimore County mortgage payment. And she found a job making, after, you know, almost a two-year search, making $12.50 an hour. Fortunately, she's getting a small portion of her pension. And this is the transition. This is what comes in to replace. So you find people being underemployed. Yes, employment comes back. People will get a job, but they're now underemployed, and people are leaving a full-time $12-an-hour job to go to a part-time $8-an-hour job to make what they used to make on one job. And that's systemic throughout our society. And the unemployment numbers shrink, but they don't reflect the amount of people that are underemployed.
I think that's absolutely true. What are your thoughts on what we were just talking about?
I think personally, you know, just in terms of my family, nobody in my family actually went to college. I'm the first one. And so it's just that everyone in my family, once they had kids, there was no place for them to go. So then once they got married, they moved out and they moved to the counties. And so no one really stayed. And my grandmother was the one who stayed. My uncle lived with her. And then once she got to she has dementia and she got older, we had to sell the house because she couldn't live by herself any longer. So it was just a generational thing that everyone sort of just moved out where they went where the jobs were. And then that sort of just sustained where they ended up. For me, I ended up back in Baltimore City because I'm an artist and because I love it. but I think one of the things that was also mentioned in the earlier segment was that Curtis Bay is kind of like this area that no one really knows about. It's like Baltimore City doesn't want to acknowledge it, and the county does not want to acknowledge it either. And so we were stuck between this rock and this hard place of, like, who are we? And who's going to defend us? And who's going to actually, like, listen to our issues and take them seriously and do something about it? Because we aren't Fett Hill. We're not Canton. We're not Hamden. We're not any of those things. We are on a completely different side of the industry that drove us to be where we were and who we were. And I think that that's one of the things that just needs to be addressed, because now that that's gone, now that that's been taken away, how do you move forward? I think that those are just questions that need to be addressed.
And so you all want to chime in? How do you think about those questions?
Let's see, like, bouncing off of what she said, I just think that, but I just think that, you know, like, because of obviously what happened, reaching out and, because it's like, okay, from what I see in Curtis Bay now,
right,
you know, there aren't, you know, happy-go-lucky people all, you know, walking the streets and stuff like that. You know, what I see is 14-year-old girls in high heels walking around. It's like you have to know your community. Like, you have to know who you're talking to, and it's like how to help them, because it's like, I work, because it's like I volunteer at Safe House of Hope as well, and it's like that's a different part of the community. So it's like how she said, it's like people don't really know Curtis Bay. Well, people don't really know the people that are in Curtis Bay, and that's, you know, those are people, those are women or transgender that aren't really spoken about or acknowledged or helped out. So, and that is probably, I can say, 40% of the community. So
what's 40% of the community?
The prostitution rate, like,
it's a high. So what you're saying, what you're describing is a community that, because of the deindustrialization of the community and the falling apart of families, you're seeing implosion of people's lives.
Yeah, and people give up. People really do give up. They resort to violence. They resort to, you know, prostitution, drugs, and I recently heard at a community meeting, stealing cars or robbing cars for their parts is the new thing in Curtis Bay. In the Brooklyn area. So it's like, you have to know who you're trying, like, you have to know your community in order to progress and to move forward.
So Gary, respond to what you said. Do you feel that?
Yeah, so, like, when you ever have someone ask you as a kid, like, what school do you go to? Mm-hmm. And you tell them, and they'd be like, yeah. Well, when people ask me, I'll tell them Ben Franklin, and they'll be like, where's that? And I don't know what to tell them. Like, it's in Curtis Bay. Where's that? Mm-hmm. So the closest thing I can get to telling them where I live is they'll remember Cherry Hill, and it's not because of their good reputation. It's mostly like he said, like, the industries that's really makes up the jobs here. Because if you think about it, like, there's no other big places where you can think about where, like, a bundle of people work at. Like, that was, I'm slipping on my words. That was like the main thing here. So, like, with.
So in some way, so what basically you're saying is, like, you can feel a sense of isolation.
Yeah.
Just simply by people saying, where do you go to high school? What community are you in? Because nobody knows where it is. Nobody's ever heard of Ben Franklin High School or Curtis Bay.
Yeah.
There's something like, you know, this is something over there. So, I mean, so some ways, the stuff you're doing, maybe just kind of dawned on me, is the Filbert Garden that you all work in, mm-hmm. that in some ways that's like a ray of light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is. And right? It is. Because it makes it hard when there are not that many jobs in Curtis Bay. So it's like, it's easier to go down the street and, you know, cop something than to take the bus and, like, 40 minutes to go get work. So with Filbert Street Garden, you know, it is in the area. I'm there I try to be there almost every day just to have the kids come out and, you know, stay or have volunteers come and help out. So it is, you know, it is progressing and it is helping and, you know, slowly but surely.
I was going to say that, like, my family, my mom, we used to live in Annapolis, and it was local. Like, she didn't have to go far to get to her job. We moved out here, and she went job to job for, like, a few months. And now she works at BG&E, which isn't even, like, in, like, she's a representative. If you call to ask about your gas and electric, you'll probably get her. So
so
she lives.
Be nice.
She's like, she's kind of over the bridge on, she's, like, she has to drive, like, 15 minutes to get to her job. It's not in Curtis Bay. Like, there's no immediate jobs. Like, even my brothers and sisters, even still now, are hopping from job to job because they live in this community still. Like, even moving outside of, like, the house, they live close, and there's no immediate jobs here.
So how do you see – so what role does the garden play in all this?
Expansion.
What do you mean?
Like, we're hoping to get – more space so that way it can be like a larger community. Maybe we can expand the community as a whole.
Gotcha.
Not even that. Like, it's more personal. It plays a big part. Like, you know, obviously it's good for your health, you know, but it has you outside in the sun, which you need. So, and, you know, you stay active, you know, you do something positive with your kids. It's a family thing, you know, and it's a really big personal role. Like, you really have to be into it. And like I said, like, because Safe House of Hope has a plot there, so it's like it helps. Well, whenever they get there, it will help the women to, you know, believe in something or just take their mind off of something negative. Actually see something grow from the ground up.
Right.
That's a very positive community activity with the garden over there. And it's a ray of hope
and a point of light for a lot of people. It can inspire people to push forward. I think it's a great thing what they're doing over in Curtis Bay. But with all of that said and done, at the end of the day, people need employment where they can make a living.
Amen to that.
You know, mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, that's what we're here for. Those communities provided employment for people who did not necessarily live in Curtis Bay or Fairfield. I never lived in Sparrows Point. I didn't grow up on a point like some of our people. I grew up in East Baltimore. And I always tell this story, Mark. I just think about how times have changed. I mean, I'm a 1978 high school graduate, Patterson. After one semester of college, I decided to find a job. I applied five jobs, Armco Steel, Beth Steel, General Motors, O'Brien Paint, take the post office test. Within a 4 to 5 month period, all of them called me for employment. That's not going to happen today because the only place left on that list I mentioned is the post office. Mm-hmm. And they're going after that.
Now they're trying to destroy
Privatize
that too.
And there was countless other people that I grew up with that may have been in the street trying to hustle to make a living, but they had alternatives. And what has happened is the jobs have left, and the only thing left for some people is the negative alternative. And until jobs come back, unfortunately, we're putting people between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah, and
We actually got to break reality here, so I appreciate you all being here. Let me get a final thought, Shannon. Again, just very quickly.
Sure.
As the Curtis Bay, as the person who actually grew up in deep roots in this community of Curtis Bay.
I would just like to say that I know that there's a lot of issues there that we can't simply address and fix. And one of the things that I think that the Garden does, it just brings a place for community to grow and for education to happen and for positivity to happen and thrive. And so I think if nothing else, like that's a way for people from all over the neighborhood to come together and to share stories and to grow together. And, you know, every time I'm there working on my plot, somebody new just comes in and I don't know who they are. And we just start this conversation and, you know, they don't even have a plot there. So I think it's a way for people to just gravitate towards and get outside of those things that maybe we see as some of the negatives.
Well, I want to encourage everybody this Sunday to join the UMBC students and the folks in Curtis Bay and more and the people at UMBC to raise money for the Filbert Street Community Garden. It's the Garden Gala Fundraiser. You don't have to wear a tux. Be down. Taking place this Sunday, May the 18th, from 4 to 9 p.m. at the 2640 space, which is at 2640 St. Paul Street in Charles Village. It's an evening of fun, food, music, silent auctions, raffles, games. And tickets can be purchased at the event or at missiontix.com. It'll be a great event. I want to thank our guests for being here this hour. Gary Brown, good to meet you. Welcome to the studio. Stephanie Garcia, good to meet you. AmeriCorps volunteer in Curtis Bay. Mike Lewis, good to have you here. Shannon, it's great to meet you. Good luck with your artwork and everything else that you're doing. It's good to have all four of you here. So thank you all so much for being part of this program today. It's been great. Folks, thank you all for producing this series from UMBC Students on Deindustrialization. It filled our airwaves during this course of the week. It was a great week to hear it all. We learned a great deal. You do great work. And thank you so much, all of you, for being part of the show. We're going to take a very brief break. We're going out here with Billy Cobham, who is playing with Ron Carter and Herbie Hancock, born on this day in 1944. So enjoy his drumming now as we go through. We come back talking about this incredibly interesting conference coming to Baltimore on economic democracy. Stay with us. We'll be right back.